You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy as Visible Speech, Collected Works, Volume 279, translated by Vera and Judy Compton Burnett. This is Lecture 6, entitled Different Aspects of the Soul Life, The Inner Nature of Color. Yesterday we concerned ourselves with various moods and shades of feeling, and with the way in which these can be expressed by means of eurythmic gesture. Today, to begin with, we will continue along somewhat similar lines. Taking our start from the point at which we left off yesterday, we will first consider the mood of devotion or piety, German Andacht. It is very necessary, when trying to experience some such mood of soul, to realize that eurythmy does not attempt to interpret by means of ordinary mime. On the contrary, as we saw when studying the vowels and consonants, eurythmy seeks to draw the plastic form corresponding to such a feeling and mood from out of the whole human being, the whole human organization. We know that in the case of the vowels and consonants, the movements are formed in such a way that they simply imitate and make visible what really exists as a kind of air form when the human being speaks. When we speak, we make certain forms in the air. If by any means we were able to retain these forms and to hold them fast, we should have the original forms of the gestures which we use to express the sounds. If, however, we wish to express some definite mood of soul, then we naturally approach much more closely to the arbitrary gesture, to the gesture which arises in ordinary everyday life, when we ourselves are experiencing the mood in question. It is undeniable that today many people avoid the use of gesture, because apparently they have an idea that gesture is not the thing. On the other hand, however, the more the human being loses himself in feeling, the more he develops a mood of soul, transcending the ordinary life of every day. So much the more does the use of gesture become necessary. And such a mood of soul is that of devotion. In this devotional mood, man has always felt the need for making a certain gesture, and the eurythmic gesture for devotion is one which, in its very nature, corresponds to the instinctive attitude adopted when this mood arises in the soul. For this reason, the eurythmic gesture for devotion approximates more nearly to the naturalistic position than can be the case with most of the other movements. To express this mood of devotion, the arms are held downward, close to the body, and then bent upward from the elbow, the hands and fingers taking up a position corresponding to one of the vowels, oo, for instance, or ah. Thus, according to the shade of feeling which one wishes to introduce into the mood of devotion, any one of these gestures may be adopted. It is important that the gesture expressing this mood should be carried out in such a way that it is separated right off from the movements otherwise occurring in the course of the poem, so that, in order to get the best effect, it is as well, in such a case, to make use of the gesture at the beginning and again at the end of the poem. If, however, a devotional mood runs continuously through the whole of the prayer, the movement can be made at the beginning and at the end of every verse. Will you now make use of this gesture when I say the following words? O Holy Spirit, hearken to the cry of my soul. O göttlicher Geist, erhöre meines Herzens Ruf. The gesture should here be made both before and after the sentence. It would be especially good if the onlooker were actually to see how the upper arms are drawn downward, pressed against the sides. This should precede the actual gesture for devotion. Parenthesis C diagram, close parenthesis. An intensification of the mood of devotion is the mood of solemnity or ceremonial, Feierlichkeit. This mood of solemnity is in a way not unlike the mood of knowledge, of wisdom. Only in the latter case the movement is reversed. Thus, to express knowledge, we make use of the same movement toward the right as we use toward the left when expressing solemnity. This can only be experienced when there is an absolutely clear realization of the relation existing between these two moods of feeling. Knowledge entails the taking into ourselves of something outside, something which we wish to unite with our own being. Thus the point is that we do not take knowledge in its deep significance into the gesture. If man had no knowledge, he could not be said to be man at all. It is through the capacity for absorbing knowledge that he first becomes truly human. So that knowledge, wisdom, should be looked upon as something which adds to the dignity of man, but which, on the other hand, contains within it a certain activity of soul. Activity is always expressed in eurythmy by turning toward the right. If we take the mood of knowledge and change it, making it more passive, more devotional, we get the feeling of solemnity. But wherever the passive element enters in, wherever there is little feeling of activity, then we turn toward the left and make our movements toward the left. And it is in this way that we express the mood of solemnity. We make a movement similar to that of knowledge, but in this case toward the left. Let us take an example in which we can make use of this gesture. Quote, "Over the destiny of man shine the inviolable stars," close quote in German, "über menschlichen Schicksalen glänzen heilige Sterne," close quote. Here you should make the gesture both at the beginning and at the end. Begin by indicating the gesture for knowledge, and then carry it over into that of solemnity. In eurythmy, we have chiefly to do with the expression and revelation of certain qualities of soul, and we shall see that the whole content of the soul life may be divided into three categories, into thinking, feeling, and willing. Now, it is important when interpreting a poem, really, to express its fundamental character. And when this character changes in the course of a poem, when, for example, thinking passes over into feeling or feeling into will, it is then very important that this should be shown in the whole bearing and in the character of the movements. Let us take, to begin with, the two polar opposites, thinking and willing. They are indeed the most contrasted activities of the human soul. When a human being thinks, I am speaking here in the widest sense of the word, this is a process which depends upon the head as it rests quietly on the shoulders. By means of external sense perception, we cannot see the process of thought. It takes place in the quietly resting head. The activity of will is the extreme opposite of this. When the activity of will does not make its appearance in the external world in some form or another, then it remains intention only. Real activity of will makes its appearance in the external world. Such activity can be seen. But insofar as the inward experience of the human being is concerned, this will activity remains dark, just as what takes place within the human being during the night remains dark to him. The human being knows nothing of his experiences as these take place during the night. He is just as little conscious of the relation between his soul and his muscles and bones when some movement arises which is the expression of will activity. When you have a straight line, you have something before you which is absolutely definite. You need only have a small portion of a straight line, and its direction as a whole is absolutely determined. The straight line is something about which there can be no doubt whatever. The curved line, on the other hand, is something which impels us to follow it, but we do not know exactly where it is going to lead us. There are, it is true, regularly formed curved lines, but even in this case, one experiences such regularity differently from the way in which one experiences the straight line. For this reason, in eurythmy, the straight line is used to denote thought and the curved line to denote will. You must therefore try to introduce straight lines into your form when you wish to express the element of thought, and curved lines when you wish to express will activity. Now, here, of course, much depends upon the eurythmist's conception of a poem. One might say, in this particular poem I intend to express the element of will. Another says, perhaps, I shall express thought, the imparting of something, by means of thought. Two quite different conceptions. So, in cases where the matter is not absolutely obvious, the choice of interpretation lies in the hands of the individual eurythmist. This makes it necessary, when you begin to work out a poem, to put to yourselves the following question. What, in my opinion, is the fundamental character of this poem? Does it lean more toward thought? Does it impart something? Let us take, for example, the following. This is a German poem. Forgive my pronunciation, Dale, readers aside. Zu Aachen in seiner Kaiserpracht, im altertümlichen Saale, saß König Rudolfs heilige Macht, beim festlichen Krönungsmahle. Die Speisen trug der Pfalzgraf des Rheins, es schenkte der Böhme des Perlenden Weins, und alle die Wähler, die sieben, wie der Sterne Chor um die Sonne sich stellt, umstanden geschäftig der Herrscher der Welt, die Würde des Amtes zu üben. Close quote. In this poem there is a succession of thoughts, as is usually the case with the pure epic. But if at any point the thought element were to pass over into the element of will, we should have to show this also in the eurythmic form. The particular verse I have just quoted, however, would best be expressed by moving as far as possible in straight lines. Now it is, of course, also possible to combine straight lines in such a way that various figures are formed, so that you can introduce other characteristics beside thought by moving in a triangle, a square, or a pentagram, as the case may be. Readers aside, and there are three shapes, a triangle, a square, let's say, and a polygon of some kind for thinking. End of readers aside, Steiner again. On the other hand, if the thought is of a more complicated nature, you might perhaps make use of such a form as this. Readers aside, it looks like two triangles pointing at each other, one upside down, one right side up. End of readers aside. Every conceivable curved line serves to express the element of will. Feeling is shown by making use of some sort of combination of straight and curved lines. Here you have opportunity for a wide play of fancy. Now it will be necessary to work out eurythmy forms along these lines. All of you will be able to make such forms for yourselves, and by trying to do so you will create an inner relationship between the eurythmy and the poem. Then the question naturally arises, what is the connection between such forms as these and those forms which have been given as standard forms, as forms which have been worked out in such a way as to bring out the special character of the poem? You will discover, however, that these guiding lines really underlie all such forms. You will invariably find this to be the case. On the other hand, you will also find, when working out such forms, that care has been taken to show where, called for, the more intimate character of a poem. Let me read that again. On the other hand, you will also find, when working out such forms, that care has been taken to show where called for the more intimate character of a poem. What does this mean? The fact of the matter is that by far the greater number of so-called poems are in reality not poetry at all, for a true poet must be able to enter into the essential nature of language, so that what he has to say is not merely prose content, more or less crudely clothed in verse, but is expressed through the way in which he handles the language itself. To express wonder in a poem by making use of some such phrase as, "Oh, how wonderful," cannot be said to be artistic. A truly artistic sense will lead one to introduce as many ah sounds as possible into a poem at the moment when one wishes to express this feeling of wonder. In the same way, it would be good to make use of the oo sound when dealing with the past, when looking back into the past. On the other hand, when there is the wish to express the gathering together of inner forces as a result of some external contact, it would be well to introduce the a sound. Thus, when a true poet wishes to express the element of thought, he will make special use of the a sound. I am speaking now in quite an idealistic sense, for it will rarely be possible to carry out all the demands of art. If this were done, very, very few poems would be written, for which one might indeed be thankful, for the poet would not quickly acquire the necessary intuition. If a poet makes use of many A or E sounds, you may be sure that he is a poet who chiefly tends to express the element of thought. He tends to the epic in poetry. Whereas you will find that a poet who is making use of the vowel sounds A, O, and U, tends more to express feeling in his poems. A poet who makes little use of vowels and much use of consonants is one who is developing the will side of his nature. Therefore, you must follow closely the character of the poet when building up an eurythmic form. When, therefore, you observe that a poem arises more out of the intellect, and this is, of course, perfectly justifiable, you will make use of straight lines in the form. When you observe that feeling is more in evidence, you will combine both straight and curved lines. When, however, the element of will comes most strongly to expression in a poem, even thought colored by feeling, then you must make use of curved lines only. If now, bearing this in mind, you proceed to examine the various forms which have been given from time to time, you will discover, and only then can you discover, how the more intimate structure of a poem is built up and must be followed in the form. It will perhaps be interesting to see, paying at first no attention to its content, what sort of result is obtained when a poem is interpreted according to the indications which have been given for thinking, feeling, and willing. One can think of poems which lend themselves to all three methods, each of which has its own particular beauty. Let us take, for example, the well-known poem, came to give the German a try. Ich ging im Walde, so führ mich hin, nichts zu suchen. Das war mein Sinn. Im Schatten sah ich ein Blümchen stehen, wie Sterne leuchtend, wie Äuglein schön. English, wandering upon a day through the woods alone, following no end or purpose, letting fancy lead, lo, in the shade, I saw a little flower, shining like a star in heaven, lovely as a child's blue eye. Close quote. Let us in the first place interpret the poem in such a way that we bring out the story, that we emphasize the thought element. Try, therefore, to improvise a form consisting of straight lines, avoiding as far as possible all rounded movements. Ich ging im Walde so für mich hin, nichts zu suchen. Das war mein Sinn. Im Schatten sah ich ein Blümchen stehen, wie Sterne leuchtend, wie Äuglein schön. Ich wollt es brechen, das sagt es fein, soll ich zum Welken gebrochen sein. Again, English, wandering upon a day through the woods alone, following no end or purpose, letting fancy lead. Lo, in the shade I saw a little flower, shining like a star in heaven, lovely as a child's blue eye. I made as if to pluck it, but gently did it say, shall I then be broken to wither and to fade? End quote. When the poem is expressed in this way, we are left with the impression that something has been related, that we have been told something. And now try to make a form consisting of curved lines. Ich ging im Walde. In this case, you see that the storytelling element falls completely away, and there is also nothing to represent the feeling line. There is, however, a strong element of feeling when, for example, the flower says, "Soll ich zum Welken gebrochen sein?" Or again, when the poet says, "Wie Sterne leuchtend, wie Äuglein schön." Thus, this poem can be expressed either according to its thinking content, its willing content, or its feeling content. Now, try to make a form consisting of straight and curved lines. Ich ging im Walde. By so doing, you give the impression that the poem is being inwardly experienced. Straight and curved lines together indicate that the eurythmist, who is interpreting the poem, continually withdraws into himself. In the case of straight lines, the interpretation becomes more abstract, less apparent. And by this means, the whole thing retains its inward character. Much more is manifested outwardly when one passes over into curved lines. Now, today I want to speak about the significance of the colors which are to be seen on the eurythmy figures, because the study of color in this connection will do much to deepen our whole attitude toward eurythmy. Footnote: it was found that the eurythmic gestures could best be portrayed by means of figures cut out from a flat surface of wood, each one being painted with three harmonizing colors. They were carried out according to directions given by Dr. Steiner at the Goetheanum Dornach, where they may be obtained. End of footnote. Here, for instance, you have in this figure an indication of the colors corresponding to the sound ah. Of course, it is obviously impossible in our eurythmy to show the colors of all the different sounds, as this has been done in the case of the eurythmy figures. For if one were to do so, one would have, for instance, when an ah or an o occurred in the same line, to change, while this line was being recited, from one costume into another, that we are not yet able to do. We already know by experience the difficulties which arise when the costumes have to be changed between two consecutive poems. But if in the course of a poem of four verses, let us say, perhaps 22 or 28 changes had to be effected, there would be no coping with the situation. Nevertheless, the colors are represented here in these figures are fundamentally true. And it is a fact that one is only able to enter right into the nature of the different sounds when one is able to experience them also as color. Let us consider once again the sound ah, the sound expressing wonder, astonishment. Fundamentally speaking, color may be said to be the external expression of our feeling life. Our feeling life is objectified in the outer world as color. The reason why there is so much disagreement as to the nature of color is that people do not observe that color is really the external counterpart of the life of the soul. Now, to return to the feeling of amazement, of wonder, you will experience this feeling in the gesture of awe. And you must ask yourselves, what colors are called up in me by this gesture? Here your feelings will lead you to the color combination seen on this figure, blue-violet. That is to say, a combination of the so-called dark colors. Let us, on the other hand, take O. The mood lying behind O is that of embracing something. Here you need brighter colors, such as shown in the eurythmy figure for the O sound. For the reason already given, it is not always possible to use these colors as they are represented here in the eurythmy figures. It will, however, be of the very greatest assistance to you if, when practicing, you call up in yourselves the feeling of color in sound, the colors, for instance, of ah, o, or e, or again of oo, which is, as we know, the expression of fear. In this way, you enter by degrees into a more intimate relationship with the nature of the different movements. Thus, when practicing it as a good exercise to dress oneself in imagination in accordance with the colors of the eurythmy figures. This is very much to be recommended. Picture now the colors for the sound A, the pale yellow combined with a certain amount of green. One feels how red and blue lose themselves in green. While with blue and violet one has the feeling of yielding oneself up, as in the case of ah and oo, one has in the mood of self-assertion or of taking something into one's own being, the feeling of lighter colors. In the A sound, we have the expression of being affected by something and of standing up against it. This is expressed in the green color. Green is obtained by mixing together yellow and blue, thus by a combination of a light and a dark color. Here we have the A expressed directly through the color itself. You grow into the feeling of this gesture when you associate it with this color. It is quite impossible to enter into these things with the understanding. They can only be felt and experienced inwardly. For our purposes, however, we will assume that we have absorbed all this and have come so far as to recognize that the mood of any particular sound is really represented by the corresponding eurythmic figure. Let us take the mood of the A sound. One will gradually discover, for oneself, that whole poems are really permeated throughout with the A mood. However many other vowels were to occur in such a poem, it might, nevertheless, have the A mood running right through it. Take, for example, a poem or any text which is to be expressed in eurythmy, in which, let us say, there continually occurs the feeling of being unpleasantly affected by something, but at the same time a certain resistance against what is affecting one in this way. When a poem has such a mood running through it, we shall do well to choose these colors, A figure, for the dress and veil. The important thing is to learn to associate definite colors with each particular sound. Then we shall gradually reach the point at which we are able to select dresses and veils suitable to a poem as a whole. I mention all this for a very good reason, and that is to prevent the delusion arising that when a eurythmist has learned the movements for A, A, E, O, etc., there is nothing more to be done. Certainly the eurythmist may be able to do it all, but this by itself is no proof that he can convey it to others. You must not forget that the impression created by the eurythmic gestures is very powerful. Very powerful forces are at work, although we may not be conscious of them. There is all the difference in the world between those who, in their desire to master eurythmy very rapidly, would be liable to believe, for instance, that the sound E has been made when the arm is simply held out in the right direction, and those who make the E in such a way that the stretched movement is clearly visible. There is a great difference whether I make the movement in this way or in this way, whether I merely extend the arms or whether I bring the stretched feeling to a visible expression. In order to acquire free artistic movements while actually carrying out any gesture, it is necessary to be conscious of the feeling and mood contained in the sound in question. This, however, can only come about when one really studies the individual sounds. And an important feature of this study is the clothing of oneself in imagination, in the corresponding colors. All this should be taken into account in the teaching of eurythmy, both as an art and as a means of education. Eurythmists must accustom themselves to live in the world of color. This experience of color was natural to humanity in the days of the old clairvoyance, but has since been lost. It appeared again in a somewhat distorted form at the end of the Kali Yuga, in certain more or less pathological cases. And at that time one met such people who maintained that Vienna was the color of dark lilac, Czernowitz yellow, Prague yellowish-orange, Berlin a combination of yellow and gray, Paris a shimmering of rose color and blue, etc., etc. At that time people were to be found who talked in this sort of fashion, and anyone possessing a feeling for such things could up to a point understand what it was that they were trying to express. In the same way, every human being has his own particular color. This color is, of course, closely connected with the astral body, which, as we know, changes with every varying emotion. Nevertheless, each individual human being may be said to possess his own fundamental color. Thus, to the question, "You were at such and such a place, what sort of people did you meet there?" one might answer, "The color of the man I saw was blue," and another, "The color of the man I saw was red." Such a point of view is quite justifiable. It is possible to feel things in this way, for in reality it is the same impression as that which arises in the case of ordinary physical color. It is therefore a good exercise to call up in one's mind the connection existing between any special movement and its underlying character and color. (See Rhythmic Figures). Here it will be of assistance to practice the sound in some such way as this. You might, for instance, take the vowel sounds a, u, a, o, e, and allow the following colors to stream through the movements: blue-violet, blue-green, greenish-yellow, reddish-yellow, red-yellow-orange. You must experience the color and make the movements simultaneously, thus working at the same time in the realm of color and of sound. By this means, the movements will become noticeably flowing and supple, and you will soon see that a certain style is being developed. This brings us to the end of today's lecture, and tomorrow we shall continue the study of the characteristics underlying the various aspects of the soul life. The end of Lecture 6.